I had a life sentence. I had 999 years to be exact. I just got on my knees and I was like, God.
Your appeals are done. Told 7 times, that's not gonna happen. It was a commutation that you were seeking.
I did it in faith. There's a big clock, like the NFL draft. I'm watching the clock tick, and I can't tell my two people that, hey, listen, we had to share this 15 minutes.
A minute and 47 seconds to explain away 999 years.
My heart dropped. So they hit the clock, I get to speaking. The governor looked, he said, Mr. Gates, normally we vote at the end, but I'm not gonna make you wait. You have my vote. If you could have seen the faces of the people, because there's people in the audience, shocking, because I didn't know that day that she had personally denied 27 other people. I feel like God came and got me.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Holly Bott, and this is From Surviving to Living, the podcast where raw stories of transformation are told. This is not just a podcast. It's the power of change. All right, so this is From Surviving to Living. Welcome to the show. This is the Spotlight series, and I have a really great guest here today, Coley Gates. And Coley has a story that it is really one filled with hope. You said you've written 3 books, is that right? And the title of one of them was
The Game with No Winners.
The Game with No Winners. I'm just gonna turn it over to you and let you tell, you know, about yourself.
Okay, as you said, my name is Coley Gates. Yeah. I had a life sentence. So I had 999 years to be exact.
And that's an incredible number to me. Tell us how you came to have a sentence of 999 years in prison.
My father was a military man, and after the military, he came back to an unwelcoming community. He became a drug dealer, and then eventually a pimp. Of course, my mother and him broke up because my mother was not with the lifestyle that he was now choosing. So I grew up seeing pimps, drug dealers, and gang members. That was the environment I was raised in. And so my lifestyle was different. I came home many times to the door being kicked in, house raided, things tore up. So as a young man, the things that people label crime wasn't really crime. That was the life that I was raised up in. And so, of course, as you grow older, you begin to know better and do better. But as a child, you don't know better. And so you start emulating the people and the things that you see. I remember as young, I didn't want to be my father. I wanted to be the best I could be in the life that was shown to me. In that lifestyle, the best is the worst. Ironically, even though my father and my uncles and them were pimps, I couldn't stand pimps. So I knew I wasn't going that route. But the street life, I was quote unquote good at. My name became big in the streets. And so in 1998, how I land myself in prison, my best friend at the time, you know, we use the word loosely, you know, coming up in the streets, best friends. He found himself in a position where he killed a man. I was raised in the streets, so telling was not an option to me. Like, I was not gonna tell, I was not gonna. And so when I got arrested, the officers at the time came in the interview room. Literally, their little words were, we know you didn't do this one, but we're going to get you for it.
Had they caught your friend at this time?
No, he was still free. They arrested me believing I was the actual one who committed the murder.
Did that surprise you, sitting there and being the focus where they think that you've done this?
No, it didn't surprise me. Like I said, it made sense. Like the life that I had lived up to that point, everybody believed it was me, not just the police. Everybody, it was definitely him, you know? And so when they found out it wasn't me, that didn't matter to them, because now it's like, okay, like they told me, we know you didn't do this one, but we're going to get you for it.
Right. So what happened after your arrest and meeting them?
So I was arrested. I was taken before the grand jury on first degree murder. The grand jury ruled that I found me guilty for aiding and abetting first-degree murder charges. So it went from first degree to aiding and abetting first degree. And so I sat in the county. I had never really been locked up for anything. As a juvenile, I did, but this was the first time I had been locked up as an adult. I have a lot of enemies, so they sent me to the hole. I ended up staying up all night reading the Bible. I just got on my knees and I was like, God, I never asked God to release me. Mm-hmm. I said, God, whatever happens from this point on, I'm just going to serve.
How old were you at this time?
At this time, I was 18. It was 2 weeks after my 18th birthday that I got arrested. Now I'm in the county. I have a lot of enemies. So they sent me to the hole, and I was in the hole. And in the hole, you don't have nothing. And so, but the first thing you do when you go to any cell is clean it up. So I grabbed the tissue and everything and began to wipe everything down. Then as I got to the floor to clean the floor, it was a book in the back of under the bed. So I grabbed the book, no cover on it, but it didn't matter. I'm in the hole, so whatever the book is, I'm going to read it. You know? Lo and behold, it's the Bible.
Had you ever read the Bible at all before?
I've read some few scriptures here and there. Mm-hmm. Going to church with my mother every blue moon. And so I'm like, I'm in the hole. I remember because I opened it up to the book of Daniel. And I ended up staying up all night reading the Bible. This was my introduction, like, to God. And I'm like, but for some reason, I believed everything, as wild as the book of Daniel is, I believed everything in it. And so I stayed up all night. The next morning, it was like 6 a.m. I just prayed. I just got on my knees and I was like, God, I don't know if I'm too bad for you to say. And out of nowhere, at the time, I didn't know what was happening to me, but I know now what was the Holy Spirit came on. Mm-hmm. And I just begin to cry and speak in tongues. And I'm tripping because now the guards are coming to take me to court. But I'm speaking in tongues and I'm like, in my head, I'm like, they're going to think I'm crazy. You know, I'm like, they're going to think I'm going nuts. And so I'm trying to stop, but it's flowing. And so as they're cuffing me and I'm getting ready to go, as we trail off down the hallway, it ceases. And I go to court and I come back. And you get one call, so I called my mom, and I'm like, Mom, hey. And I just started explaining to her what took place, and that's when she broke down what had happened. And so that was an introduction to really knowing God. And it's crazy because it took off from there. Like, I never asked God to release me. Mm-hmm. So my prayer was, I said, God, whatever happens from this point on, I'm just going to serve. I didn't know what was in front of me. Of course, I wanted to go home. You know, I wanted to go do 9 and 9 years. I end up getting released from the hole, and they take me up to a mod. I'm the youngest dude in the mod. We're having Bible studies in my cell, like I'm a pastor or something.
Yeah.
I don't know how or what, but right. I'm in every night. Everybody's in my cell, and I'm reading the Bible, talking about Jesus, telling them, you know what I'm saying, what Jesus did.
Right. I think about how God uses anybody in any circumstance. He's more powerful than our limitations, right?
I was just, it was crazy, but it seemed so natural. Every night we have drug addicts, you have old enemies, fresh old enemies of mine now in the cell.
You know, with
why,
you.
Yeah, with while I'm reading the Bible and praying, like.
It reminds me of that verse from Proverbs that says, when a man pleases God, God makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Yeah.
And I'm living proof that is exactly what happened. When you get that piece of paper and you read it and it says 999 years, 99 months, 99 days, to heal from that takes every bit of Jesus. It's a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
It hit me the first time I heard my son's voice on the phone. So during this process, I'm facing this time, my dad dies. But 2 nights before he died, I had a dream. And in the dream, I had seen my dad in the casket. And I woke up, it was like 3 a.m. I'm crying because it was so real. Next morning, let us out, call my daddy, still alive. A day later, he passes.
Wow.
And so, while I'm facing all this time, I lose my father. I'm literally in the county, orchestrating a funeral from a prison phone of my father. So I'm thinking about, I have a little sister, I have a little brother, you know, and now our dad is gone. But it was amazing because God had given me a strength and a peace. Like, I don't know, to this day, I don't know how I did that.
Yeah.
Why and well, I'm lying. Yeah, it was God. I know now how it was, but it was just like, so now my dad dies. I orchestrate his funeral from prison. I don't get to go, you know, because like, you're a murderer. You're not going to the funeral. And so now my trial's coming. And I was confident. Like, I believed that I would go home because I'm like, I didn't kill this person.
So, mm-hmm.
And I'm like, and there's nobody saying I killed this person. They're just saying I was around. And so the trial comes. It lasts a long trial, 2 weeks. At the end, I'm found guilty.
What was that like? You must have been very surprised.
At the end, I think I was kind of numb. Like, I just lost my father. I'm in a position that I've never been in, and it really didn't hit me. Like, even after the judge said guilty, I looked back to my family and I just told him, like, it's not over. Like, mm-hmm. I never believed that I would serve life in prison.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think I was going to do 25 years either, but
right.
Which I ended up doing 25 years in prison. And so it was just, it hit me the first time I heard my son's voice on the phone.
After that?
After I got found guilty, I went back to the unit. Everybody was like, what happened? Because everybody assumed I was going home too. And I'm like, I got found guilty. But I was so calm with it, they didn't believe me. The guys in the mob, they're like, quit playing, man. I'm like, no, I got found guilty.
Yeah.
And then I make a phone call and I call my son, who at the time had just turned two. And when I heard his voice, that's when it hit me.
And you had not been sentenced yet. Was that a separate hearing?
Oh, yeah, that's a separate hearing. You just found guilty.
I think about what you're saying and through my own experiences and all the way through this process, it's just a state of constant shock and new experiences that you have never been prepared for, don't know how to make it safely through, and it's a constant bombardment. I think it really takes several years to overcome that and get used to a new normal. And by the time you're about ready to help yourself, time has passed for you to help yourself.
Oh. It is. I don't believe people realize how traumatic a trial. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not. I was in the street life, so whatever comes with that, comes with
right.
You put yourself in that position. But it is. It's traumatic. Like, mm-hmm. that is a traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. Whether you're guilty or not guilty, it's a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
And to heal from that takes every bit of Jesus.
It does. And so you were sentenced at a later point. And did you know what they were asking for a sentence, or was that also a surprise?
I didn't comprehend.
Yeah.
Like, I knew, no, like, they told me, they throw the word, some life with parole.
Mm-hmm.
Some life with parole. You know, okay, life with parole. But it didn't hit until you actually realize, like, hold on. When you get that piece of paper and you read it and it says 999 years, 99 months, 99 days.
Did someone just fall asleep on the keyboard and hit the 9 key with their nose? I mean, your sentence is so bizarre. I mean, I spent time with women who have sentences that are life without parole or life, which we know is 25 years and you only serve 17. And so I've heard all that. Yours is the first sentence where they put a specific number on a real long length of time.
Yeah.
You know?
And so, after you read those numbers and you try your best to digest it, you know, like, you shipped off.
Yeah.
And I was shipped off, though, and I did 13 years in the Supermax Oak Park,
mm-hmm.
you know, and my whole bid, like my whole time, I stuck to what I told God.
Mm-hmm.
I said, God, no matter what, I'm going to serve. I never looked back. all my affiliations, all the street life. No, I didn't smoke no weed. I didn't do nothing. It's all that's in there.
Yeah.
I didn't do it yet. There were dark days. God always lifted me back up. Always. I never believed that God was going to leave me in prison over 7 appeals.
Mm.
And I filed and got denied. To hear that back to back,
yeah,
will keep crushing.
Yeah. What, you must have had friends that knew you from the street before you were incarcerated that are incarcerated with you for other, their own stuff. Were they really surprised by the new you?
Everybody was. My family, my aunties used to think, they were like, they were asking my cousins, is he still crazy? Because they couldn't believe, like,
right.
Like, you have to understand, like, when I was in the street life, I really was in the street life. Like,
yeah.
I really lived that life. Mm-hmm. And so the things that people, the movies and all that, I really did that.
Yeah.
Like, that was my lifestyle. And so when people see you take no take nothing from nobody and suit out broad daylight, they're like, there's no way that this person is serving Jesus like this. Like, it's
right.
Next to impossible. And so I'm in there with childhood friends who grew up in the neighborhood with me, and they're looking like, everybody thought, they're like, man, he's just doing it to go home.
When did you start to feel like, now I have hope that maybe I will go home? Or what made you decide to take action?
I never believed that God was going to leave me in prison for the rest of my life. From the beginning. Now, there were dark days, over 7 appeals.
Mm.
And they literally told me, you're right, but you ran out of time. Like, to hear that back to back,
yeah,
will can crush you. I battled, had times of depression in there. Like, you read this, and these people telling you, like, yeah, you're right. This fact, that fact. But you ran out of time. Mm. So there were trying times, but I'd go days and I'd be in a slump, but God always lifted me back up. Mm. Always. The Holy Spirit always lifted me back up, always lifted me back up.
So what led to your appeals are done, and you've been told 7 times that's not going to happen. So how did you decide it was a commutation that you were seeking?
So this was interesting. It was a guy coming home, going home. He had a 17-year sentence, and he had filed for one. And then he came and told me about it, like, hey, man, you should try this. And I'm like, you know, you're hopeful. Like, hey, what's the worst gonna happen? So I'm like, let me try this. And I filed and got denied.
Hmm.
And they didn't give me a reason or nothing, no hearing, no nothing. Just flat out denial.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that was in probably 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So I continue living my life, you know what I'm saying, believing God's gonna make a way. And I get shipped down to, I progressed down to medium custody now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just led to try it again. Somebody on the phone told me, like, hey, why don't you do it now? The urgency in their voice was like, I thought, okay. But I didn't do it like I did the last time. This time, I did it in faith. I sent them a release plan, you know,
like
a whole blueprint. Like, I'm not just asking you to free me. I want you to know that I thought this process out, and I understand the, you know what I'm saying, the position that I'm putting you in by releasing me. And I'm letting you know that if you release me, these things will be beneficial, not just for myself, but for others. I'm preparing for this day that now is canceled. I went back to my cell that day, closed the door. I prayed, turned on gospel music and just prayed and just was like, I was like, all right, God. Almost 2 months later, the mail comes by, your hearing date is such and such, such and such. And I'm like, it was wild.
And you, by this time, if I remember right, had begun to have some communication with the victim's family?
Yes.
How did that happen?
Oh, yeah, that was wild. Like, this is prior, the little brother of the victim reached out to me one day, sent me his number, and we begin to talk. I told him, I said, you can ask me whatever you want to ask me. I'm going to give you the truth, because I felt like I owed this to him and the family. Like, you deserve to know how you lost your big brother. And so we began to speak for like 3 years. He'd call, I'll call, we'll write. And we just began to establish a bond. You know, I'm a street guy, so initially I'm like, where this is gonna go? We actually start talking about real life, like intimate life, like, you know, his kids, my kids, his family, my family. He's from the street. So in between time, he ended up getting sent to the feds. We lose connection. And so by the time I'm leading up to my commutation, he's now home. And we're back talking. But I never even asked for his help, because that's not his position. Like,
right.
Like, you don't owe me. I owe you. I owe your family. You know what I'm saying?
Was this an appeal or in a second?
So I had to file an appeal for them to even consider hearing me.
Mm-hmm. Appeal of the previous denial.
Yes.
And you were given a core hearing, which was then canceled.
That I was supposed to be seen Monday. Friday before the Monday, I'm sleeping in my cell. I get a knock at my door. Case manager calls me down to his office. I'm thinking it's a death in the family or something. Mm-hmm. Anytime these type of interactions happens, normally somebody died.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to think, like, man, who is this? Oh my goodness. I get in this office, and his whole demeanor is like somebody died. He's like, Gase, I don't want to be the one to tell you this, but your hearing is canceled. So I said, my hearing is canceled? All the hearing is canceled, or just mine? He was like, no, your hearing is canceled. No reason, no explanation. All that month and week, I'm preparing for this day that now is canceled. At this time, it was 23 years. You finally get somebody saying, okay, we're going to hear you out.
Yeah.
And then, bam.
Day before, or a couple days before, yeah.
No explanation, no nothing. So not even a date if they're even going to hear you again. I went back to my cell that day. I closed the door. I prayed. I turned on God's music and just prayed. And just was like, I was like, all right, God. And so I go back to living my everyday prison life. You know, I'm still serving God. I'm still doing my job, you know. And I kept pushing. And almost 2 months later, the mail comes by. It's an envelope, Department of Corrections, Minnesota. You know, I'm like, okay. I slide it open. Your hearing date is such and such, such and such, such and such. I'm like, I open the cell door, and I'm on the second galley, and I just step out. And I hadn't even said nothing, but the officer seen it. And he just looked up out of all things, out of his mouth. He's like, he said, what, Gate, you going home? I guess I looked like I was glowing, because I didn't say anything. And I was like, whoa. You know what I'm saying? I just let it out. I'm like, whoa. And so I had a date. I had a time. Right here. I'm like, where everybody at? They're like, yeah, Gate, switch in. It's a lockdown. I'm like, this is impossible. My heart dropped.
You were also going to college during this time and getting a degree. And so the hearing was the date of your graduation?
Yeah, that was bananas. I go to class the next morning, and the professor is like, well, this is our first ever graduation. They wanted to vote who was going to be the guest speaker, the class speaker. He's like, no, Coley, you should do it. Ooh. I said, I'm not going to be here. And they're like, what you mean? I said, I'm going home. They vote. They still want me to be the speaker. I'm like, listen, I'm going home. And so I said, okay, this is what I do. I'll be the speaker, but you be the backup.
Yeah.
So December 20th, I graduate in the morning. I'm the speaker for the graduation. And that afternoon, I'm going to see three. I have to get three unanimous votes to go home. And so this is all on my mind going into this graduation. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the first time my mother has ever seen me speak. Mm. My older brother has ever seen me speak. This is the first time they've seen me in this light.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen my big brother in over 20 years because he was in the Fed. And so this is our first time actually seeing each other in 20 years. I give my speech. To this day, I don't know how the heck I did it. The president of MCTC said it was the best graduation speech she had ever heard in 30 years. And I'm like, it had to be God. So I leave my graduation and go back to the unit to prepare for my meeting. I walk in the unit, and the unit's on lockdown. My heart dropped. I walk back in, and I'm like, where everybody at? They're like, yeah, gate switch in. It's a lockdown. I said, oh, this can't be real. Because everybody knows when the prison is locked down, everything's canceled. No visits. There's no nothing. You're in your cell. I'm like, this is impossible. Like, my hearing is in a couple hours, and you're telling me that we're on lockdown.
The prison does not care that the courts are still operating and you need to be at a hearing. You just don't go.
There's one officer in the unit. No case managers are there. Like, everybody, like, it's... There's nobody I can talk to. And while I was at my graduation, my cellie had moved out the cell because he said I was too calm that it scared him. And so he moved out. I didn't even know he moved, though.
Yeah.
I'm going back into the unit thinking I'm going to have somebody to bounce this off of. Yeah. I go into the cell, and he's gone.
Yeah.
And so it's just me.
And God.
Me and God.
It's almost like God took everything away from you so that you would only be able to rely on him, and it would be more obvious that it was him.
And that's how it went. I went in that cell. I turned on the gospel music. First thing I turned on the gospel music, and I just paced the cell praying. Listen, gospel. And I'm just praying. The time goes by. My hearing, nobody comes to me, tells me anything. Mm-hmm. All you hear is postponed, it's canceled. Again, no nothing. I'm just in the cell. I'm looking at the clock. 3 o'clock is gone.
And that was your hearing time.
My hearing time is gone. I'm like, so I just keep praying. I'm like, all right, here we go again. 4 o'clock comes, 4:30 comes. Click, my door clicks. So I open the door. He's like, Gates, come down. I go down. And again, it's just me and the guard. He's like, your hearing, get ready for your hearing. So I'm sitting there. 30 minutes pass. He's like, Gates, go back to your cell. I go back to the cell.
Yeah.
I go back to the cell. No explanation. No.
Right.
Explanation. Go back to your cell. I go back to the cell. I'm in the cell. And I'm just like, man. I can't remember exactly how much time had passed. Eventually, my door clicks again. He's like, Gates, go to your hearing. I go out the cell. I take that long walk down the hallway to the interview room. He says, this doesn't add up, don't make sense. Why does he have a life sentence when the actual perpetrator has been home for over 8 years now? The governor looked, he said, you have my vote. That's 2 out of 3.
Yeah.
But you have to have all 3. So the governor looks over to her and he's like, Chief Justice, we want to request an immediate relief. Like, no. I get there. I'm setting up. I'm on a big screen. I have 2 people that's speaking on my behalf. They're there. I'm in the prison on video screen. I had 15 minutes to speak to the Attorney General and the Chief Justice of Minnesota. And so I'm prepared to do that. What they didn't tell me was that the 15 minutes was split between me and my other 2 speakers. There's literally a big clock like the NFL draft. That's literal. It's literally a clock that has 15 minutes on it and it's ticking down, literally. And I'm watching the clock tick, and I can't tell my 2 people that, hey, listen, we had to share this 15 minutes. They both speak. I look at the clock when they got done. It was 1:47.
Is it still counting down?
It paused when it came to me. So they stopped it at 1:47. And I'm sitting at this table, and I couldn't say nothing because I was on mute. My mic was on mute. So I just had to wait it out.
Yeah.
And so they look, I got this great presentation that I'm gonna give on why. Who I am now versus who I was, All that's out the window.
Yeah.
I got a minute and 47 seconds to tell these people, explain to these people why they should release.
A minute and 47 seconds to explain away 999 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You and I both know that's impossible.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, the greatness of the God we serve.
Yeah.
So, they hit the clock. I get to speaking. I'm speaking from the top of my head now.
Yeah.
Like, I'm freestyling. But in the midst of my freestyling, I said something that caused the Chief Justice to lean forward. And it was not a good lean forward.
Mm.
And so, after I was done speaking, the Chief Justice says, she has some questions, but she waits on the governor. The governor speaks first.
Mm-hmm.
He says, Mr. Gates, I have two questions for you. And I'm like, okay. I'm thinking, okay, he wants to understand the case and everything. He says, one, I want to know, how did you maintain such excellent behavior and keep a tight family bond under these conditions? I wasn't expecting that question. Like, out of all the questions I asked, that was not one that I even would have ever thought of reciting.
Yeah.
And so I told him the truth. I said, listen, I believe in Jesus Christ. I live my life every day like I believe. And every resource that was given to me, whether it was letters, phones, or emails, that's what I did with my family to stay in contact with my family and my friends. And so we utilize that visits consistently, and we just share life with each other. And the governor looked, he said, Mr. Gates, normally we vote at the end. He said, but I'm not going to make you wait. I just want to let you know right now you have my vote.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what? I was blown away because I wasn't expecting, you know what I'm saying? Like, the question, and then the immediate vote. Then Keep Ellison, the attorney general, he's like, Gates, I have a couple questions as well. But the way he said it with authority, like, I'm like, okay, here comes the grill. He's about to grill me about my case.
Yeah.
You know, because the way he said it in his posture. And he said, I'm confused about something. He said, the person that actually pulled the trigger is home and has been home for years, right? I'm like, yes, sir. He's like, so my second question is, you were the driver of the car, right? And my sister yells from the audience, yeah. I'm like, please be quiet. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is not the time for this, you know? And so, but he accepts her answer. He's like, yeah. And I'm like, yes, sir. He looks at the governor. He says, this doesn't add up. Don't make sense. And the governor looks back like, and he says, why does he have a life sentence when the actual perpetrator has been home for over 8 years now? And they go back and forth. Then Mr. Keep Ellison says, Mr. Gates, I ain't gonna make you wait either. He says, I wanna let you know you have my vote as well. I'm like,
wow.
That's two out of three.
Yeah.
But you have to have all three.
Yeah.
And so now they pass the microphone to the Chief Justice. I believe her name is Gilday, if I'm pronouncing it right. And she said, Mr. Gates, you said something when you were speaking. And she leaned forward and she looked in the camera. And she's looking like, and her body language is reading, you messed up. And she proceeds, when you were speaking, you said you messed up. What do you mean you messed up? And she said it in like you don't mess up. You know. And so I just told her, I said, what I meant by when I messed up is in my life, I realized there were a bunch of little mess ups and mistakes that went unchecked.
Mm.
And because they went unchecked, they led to this day where this man lost his life because I didn't check those little mess ups.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked. And she sat back. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like, this might not be it. And so the governor looks over to her and he's like, Chief Justice, you know our vote. We want to request an immediate relief. She's like, like, no. She was like, let's see him in 6 months. I don't know what the little brother's gonna say. I didn't cry the whole time until I heard him speak.
Yeah.
He said, when I first met Coley, I wanted to kill him. But then when I got to know him, even though I lost a brother, it felt like I gained a new brother. And then she was like, I want to hear from the victim's family. Now, really, they've had over 3 years to contact the victim's family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like this was a surprise meeting and nobody was notified there.
Mm-hmm.
They chose not to be there. And so then Keith Ellison's like, he changes his vote. He's like, yeah, I want to hear from the victim's family too. I'm like,
okay. It's going backwards. Yeah. No.
It went from, but at this point, I didn't do 24 years. So what's right. 6 more months? Okay. See, I'll be back in 6 months when we'll figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Then Keith Ellison, he raised back up. He said, hold on, Mr. Gates, didn't you say you talked to the victim family? I said, yes, sir. Then Governor Walz was like, so you have a phone number for him? I said, yes, sir. He said, can we add a phone number? I said, no, sir.
He must have been so surprised.
Oh, you should have seen everybody. If you could have seen the faces of the people, because there's people in the audience,
yeah.
And it's them. And there's people on the panel, and everybody on the panel was looking like what?
This is your opportunity for release. And the answer is no, you can't have it.
Yes. And so the governor's looking like, why not? And so he's like, basically, why not? And I said, listen, I don't feel like they owe me anything. I'm not going to just bring this and put them in this position.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, he grabbed his mic. He said, I don't know why he grabbed the mic because we still heard him, but he was like, I know this has never been done before, but let's pause the meeting so he can go back and call and ask if we can talk to him. And so they paused the meeting, send me back to the unit that's on lockdown to use the phone to call the victim's little brother.
Yeah.
So I call him. I call, no answer.
Mm.
I call 3 times, no answer.
Mm-mm.
I call my mother and have her text him. Still no answer. I call again, no answer. At this point, I'm sitting at the phone booth like this. I'm like, I literally took the phone. I was like, Lord, please let this dude answer the phone. Dial again. Hello? He's like, bro, what's wrong? Because I don't never call like this. He's like, bro, right. What's wrong? I said, listen, I'm sitting in front of the governor, and they asked me for your number because they want to talk to you. He said, why don't you give them the number? I said, bro, you don't owe me nothing. I said, I'm not just giving them your number. He said, man, give them the number. And so I hang up the phone, run back down the hallway. They proceed with the meeting. I tell them, hey, listen, this is the number. The governor again tells us his status. He says, I know we've never done this before, but does somebody have a cell phone?
It wasn't even his cell phone? No. Like he borrowed a phone.
Cell phone from the commissioner of the DOC. he called him for Paul Snell's cell phone. Like, and puts him on, he's like, he explains to him before he puts him on speaker, do you know what's going on? And they had their conversation, then he puts them on speaker. Now, to this point, I don't know what the little brother's gonna say.
Yeah.
Like, we're good,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't mean he wants me home, because, you know what I'm saying? Like, we built a relationship, but at the end of the day, this was his big brother.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And so, I don't know what he's gonna say. He could say, I love him, but no, we don't want him home, but. Or could we slow, get him home in a few years? Or, you know, he could say anything. But governor passes to the chief justice who wanted to speak to him. And she's like, do you understand what's going on? He's like, yes. She's like, what is your family or what's your opinion concerning the situation with Mr. Gates? And he tells her, he says, if you asking me, I'm asking you, y'all to release him right now. And then he goes into his spiel. He said, And this is the first time I didn't cry the whole time until I heard him speak.
Yeah.
Like what he said made me cry. He was like, I know this doesn't make sense to a lot of people. He said, when I first met Coley, I wanted to kill him. He's like, I grew up in the streets, I wanted to kill him. He said, but then when I got to know him, even though I lost a brother, it feel like I gained a new brother. Mm-hmm. He said, every time my life is going sideways, it's him that's speaking to me to get me to change course. He said, he saved my life so many times by just our conversations. Mm-hmm. He said, so if you're asking me, we need him out here now. Mm-hmm. I'm crying. Everybody in the audience look like they seen a ghost. Like, what? The governor looks over to Chief Justice. He's like, and she's like, you got my vote. When I left, I literally got in the van and turned my back to the prison and didn't even look. As they pulled off, I didn't look back. I was caged for 25, in a cage. You know, even though I believed God was gonna come get me, there was moments of doubt for sure. I had 999 came in. The greatness of God, you can't make that up.
And that I have been to pardon and commutation hearings for other friends of mine. I have seen all of that, not your story, but I've seen all this type firsthand, and I have never seen the Chief Justice say yes, ever. For anyone watching, your story is, I know, more than shocking. It is the impossible happening.
And it's so shocking because I didn't know that day that she had personally denied 27 other people.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't, going into the meeting, I had no idea that like 27 other people had been no, 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 no.
Yeah.
Me and my best friend, who are both men of God, went the same day and we didn't know. I was the first one to get immediate release, but he was also granted his, and he had a life sentence plus.
Wow.
And so on the same day, me and my best friend both were told we were going home.
Yeah.
At different times, but we were both going home.
And your story about being emotional at the moment that the victim's brother was speaking.
That was an experience. I couldn't have scripted it. Mm-mm. Never in my entire time of being incarcerated, that there 25 years, did I ever think that it would come to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Who, the victim's family was part of my saving.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, God, you can't make that up. Like,
mm-mm.
And then the greatness of God, like, for me, I feel like God came and got me. Like,
yes.
You know what I'm saying? He came and got, I had 999 years, he came and got.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't deserve it and earn it.
It was a gift. And it reminds me, too, I'm gonna get the Bible here so I can read it accurately. Proverbs 27:2, or 1 and 2. Do not boast of yourself and tomorrow, for you know not what a day may bring forth. Let another man praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips. And so it sounds like that's exactly what you had on your mind. God's going to fight for you. You were just putting in the work and then leaving the results up to God. Yeah. So you went home that same day?
No, I was supposed to go home the first week of January. I actually didn't make it home. This is how special God is. I actually got released on Valentine's Day.
Aww. That's
like, actually, I actually went home on Valentine's Day.
That is awesome. And so what was that like walking out the door?
Man.
Whoo.
It's I don't got words that could describe that feeling. Like, I was caged for 25, in a cage, you know? So it's like, and even though I believed God was gonna come get me, them wasn't easy years of, you know, there was moments of doubt for sure.
Yeah.
And so when I left, I literally got in the van and turned my back to the prison and didn't even look. As they pulled off, I didn't look back.
Yeah.
I literally turned my back and watch the van ride off. And I
yeah.
The only time you win is when you accept Christ and eternal life is given to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the win. A lot of people thought I was crazy, but I said, God is going to release. And when it happened, they were like, there's men in prison right now to this day who are serving God because of what God did in and through me and for me.
How long ago was that?
It's been a year and almost a year and a half, yes.
Is this the time where you've written the three books, or did you write some of those while you were incarcerated?
I wrote the three books in prison. I published my book, Uncommon Sense, We Are Bigger Than the Box You Put Us In, from the phone in prison. Mm-hmm. And it's on Amazon right now. My other two books, If My Tears Could Talk, is finished, and I'm about to release it. And then my life story, which is titled The Game With No Winners,
mm-hmm.
which I completed out here, started in there, completed it out here.
So explain for the people watching what the title means.
Oh, so The Game With No Winners is, I realized that the life you live without God, I don't care what life it is, whether it's in the streets, whether it's corporate, there's not a win in there.
Mm-mm.
The only time you win is when you accept Christ and eternal life is given to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the win.
Yeah.
That's the only win we have.
Yeah.
Everything we have, everything other than that, it perishes.
Mm-hmm.
You can't take your money with you. The street life doesn't, you never win in the street life. I don't care how far you get it. No, you'll pay for it in the end. But when Jesus Christ is your Lord and Savior,
yes,
that's the win.
It is. I just like quoting Tozer and C.S. Lewis. But he said, yes, every follower of Jesus should be a walking miracle, the kind of person who can never be explained. Mm. And that sounds like what your life was as you were incarcerated and are now free.
And that's what the testimony has been. Your testimony is not for you, it's for others.
Yes.
There's men in prison right now to this day who are serving God because of what God did in and through me and for me.
Yeah.
Like, not me, but what God did. They seen God. They know, they were in their cells next to me, and they remember me telling them I was gonna go home. God gonna get me out.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people thought I was crazy, but I said, God is going to release me.
Mm-hmm.
And when it happened, they were like, whoa.
How is your family taking your reception back into reentry? They must be delighted that you're here. Your son?
Yes. I have a son and a daughter and two grandchildren.
Yeah.
And my mother's still alive, thank God, and my stepfather. You know, I'm a new person.
Yeah.
I'm not the same person I was when I went in.
Yeah.
And so there's an adjustment in that area.
Yeah.
No, but it's a beautiful thing because my entire family is so excited.
You must get asked, what were challenges that I had to overcome on reentry?
I have this thing, the Holy Spirit revealed to me one day, and I always tell people, I don't have problems, I have opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever comes my way that somebody may label a problem, I don't label that. It's an opportunity to grow, to give, to love, whatever. And so, challenges, yes. I think the biggest challenge for me was relationships. Mm-hmm. I realized that everybody had a vision of what my freedom would mean for them versus what it meant for me.
Mm-hmm.
Not good or bad or anything, but you know, they love you. They've had this picture that they painted the whole time you've been gone because they love you, and you have this. But when their vision and your actuality meet, that's where things get challenging.
Yeah.
No, I'm learning that along this journey, like, whatever comes, God got me.
Mm-hmm.
I just got to stay the course.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Whatever it looks like, ain't no sense in me anxious about it, fearful about it, or mad about it. I just got to trust and believe, because I don't believe in coincidences or accidents. So whatever's coming into my life, God has allowed for whatever reason. If he's allowed it, then there's a purpose, and let's go with it.
I want to have you back here as a guest when you finish publishing these other books that you just told us about, and then you can maybe share more of your story.
I'll gladly come back.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, well, I am going to wrap it up then. And for everyone watching, for more great stories like this one, you can watch the Spotlight series on hollybot.me and follow, like, subscribe, leave comments. We like to hear your encouraging words for our guests and for me. So thank you for being with us and watching.
Look for more episodes that inspire at hollybot.me. Until next time, remember, your story is never over. God's grace is always waiting to rewrite it. This is From Surviving to Living.